The Cold War Begins, Chapter 36. The American people, 140 million strong, cheered their nation's victories in Europe and Asia at the conclusion of World War II. But when the shouting faded away, many Americans began to worry about their future. 4 fiery years of global war had not entirely driven from their minds the painful memories of 12 desperate years of the Great Depression. Still more ominously, victory celebrations had barely ended before America's crumbling relations with its wartime ally, the Soviet Union, threatened a new and even more terrible international conflict. Post-war economic anxieties. The decade of the 1930s had left deep scars. Joblessness and insecurity had pushed up the suicide rate and dampened the marriage rate. Babies went unborn as pinched budgets and sagging self-esteem wrought a sexual depression in American bedrooms. The war had banished the blight of depression, but would the respite last? Grim-faced observers were warning that the war had only temporarily lifted the pall of economic stagnation, and that peace would bring the return of hard times. Homeward-bound GIs, so gloomy predictions ran, would step out of the Army's chow lines and back into the bread lines of the unemployed. The faltering economy in the initial post-war years threatened to confirm the worst predictions of the doomsayers who foresaw another Great Depression. Real gross national product, GNP, slumped sickeningly in 1946 and 1947 from its wartime peak. With the removal of wartime price controls, prices giddily levitated by 33% in 1946 to 1947. An epidemic of strikes swept the country. During 1946 alone, some 4.6 million laborers laid down their tools, fearful that soon they could barely afford the autos and other goods they were manufacturing. The growing muscle of organized labor deeply annoyed many conservatives. They had their revenge against the labor's New Deal gains in 1947, when a Republican-controlled Congress, the first in 14 years, passed the Taft-Hartley Act over President Truman's vigorous veto. Labor leaders condemned the Taft-Hartley Act as a slave labor law. It outlawed the closed, all-union shop, made unions liable for damages that resulted from jurisdictional disputes among themselves, and required union leaders to take a non-communist oath. Taft-Hartley was only one of several obstacles that slowed the growth of organized labor in the years after World War II. In the heady days of the New Deal, unions had spread swiftly in the industrialized Northeast, especially in huge manufacturing industries like steel and automobiles. But labor's post-war efforts to organize in the historically anti-union regions of the South and West proved frustrating. The CIO's Operation Dixie, aimed at unionizing Southern textile workers and steelworkers, failed miserably in 1948 to overcome lingering fears of racial mixing. And workers in the rapidly growing service sector of the economy, many of them middle-aged women, often working only part-time in small shops, widely separated from one another, proved much more difficult to organize than the thousands of assembly line workers who in the 1930s had poured into the auto and steel unions. Union membership would peak in the 1950s and then begin a long, unremitting decline. The Democratic administration, meanwhile, took some steps of its own to forestall an economic downturn. It sold war factories and other government installations to private businesses at fire sale prices. It secured passage in 1946 of the Employment Act, making it government policy to promote maximum employment, production, and purchasing power. The Act created a 3-member Council of Economic Advisors to provide the President with the data and the recommendations to make that policy a reality. Most dramatic was the passage of the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, better known as the GI Bill of Rights or the GI Bill. Enacted partly out of fear that the employment markets would never be able to absorb 15 million returning veterans at war's end, the GI Bill made generous provisions for sending the former soldiers to school. In the post-war decade, some 8 million veterans advanced their education at Uncle Sam's expense. The majority attended technical and vocational schools, but colleges and universities were crowded to the blackboards as more than 2 million ex-GIs stormed the halls of higher learning. The total eventually spent for education was some $14.5 billion in taxpayer dollars. The act also enabled the Veterans Administration, VA, to guarantee about $16 billion in loans for veterans to buy homes, farms, and small businesses. By raising educational levels and stimulating the construction industry, the GI Bill powerfully nurtured the robust and long-lived economic expansion that eventually took hold in the late 1940s and that profoundly shaped the entire history of the post-war era. The Long Economic Boom, 1950 to 1970. Gross national product began to climb haltingly in 1948. Then, beginning about 1950, the American economy surged onto a dazzling plateau of sustained growth that was to last virtually uninterrupted for two decades. America's economic performance became the envy of the world. National income nearly doubled in the 1950s and almost doubled again in the 1960s, shooting through the $1 trillion mark in 1973. Americans, some 6% of the world's people, were enjoying about 40% of the planet's wealth. Nothing loomed larger in the history of the post-World War II era than this fantastic eruption of affluence. It did not enrich all Americans, and it did not touch all people evenly, but it transformed the lives of a majority of citizens and molded the agenda of politics and society for at least two generations. Prosperity underwrote social mobility. It paved the way for the eventual success of the civil rights movement. It funded vast new welfare programs like Medicare, and it gave Americans the confidence to exercise unprecedented international leadership in the Cold War era. As the gusher of post-war prosperity poured forth its riches, Americans drank deeply from the gilded goblet. Millions of depression-pinched souls sought to make up for the sufferings of the 1930s. They determined to get theirs while the getting was good. The people who had once considered a chicken in every pot the standard of comfort and security now hungered for two cars in every garage, swimming pools in their backyards, vacation homes, and gas-guzzling recreational vehicles. The size of the middle class, defined as households earning between $3,000 and $10,000 a year, doubled from pre-Great Depression days and included 60% of the American people by the mid-1950s. By the end of that decade, the vast majority of American families owned their own cars and washing machines, and nearly 90% owned a television set, a gadget invented in the 1920s but virtually unknown until the late 1940s. In another revolution of sweeping consequences, almost 60% of American families owned their own homes by 1960, compared with less than 40% in the 1920s. All of the beneficiaries of post-war prosperity, none reaped greater rewards than women. More than ever, urban offices and shops provided a bonanza of employment for female workers. The great majority of new jobs created in the post-war era went to women, as the service sector of the economy dramatically outgrew the old industrial and manufacturing sectors. Women accounted for a quarter of the American workforce at the end of World War II, and for nearly half the labor pool 5 decades later. Yet even as women continued their march into the workplace in the 1940s and 1950s, popular culture glorified the traditional feminine roles of homemaker and mother. The clash between the demands of suburban housewifery and the realities of employment eventually sparked a feminist revolt in the 1960s. The roots of post-war prosperity. What propelled this unprecedented economic explosion? The Second World War itself provided a powerful stimulus. While other countries had been ravaged by years of fighting, the United States had used the war crisis to fire up its smokeless factories and rebuild its depression-plagued economy. Invigorated by battle, America had almost effortlessly come to dominate the ruined global landscape of the post-war period. Ominously, much of the glittering prosperity of the 1950s and 1960s rested on the underpinnings of colossal military budgets, leading some critics to speak of a permanent war economy. The economic upturn of 1950 was fueled by massive appropriations for the Korean War, and defense spending accounted for some 10% of the GNP throughout the ensuing decade. Pentagon dollars primed the pumps of high technology industries such as aerospace, plastics, and electronics, areas in which the United States reigned supreme over all foreign competitors. The military budget also financed much scientific research and development, R&D, hence the name of one of the most famous think tanks, the RAND Corporation. More than ever before, unlocking the secrets of nature was the key to unleashing economic growth. Cheap energy also fed the economic boom. American and European countries controlled the flow of abundant petroleum from the sandy expanses of the Middle East, and they kept prices low. Americans doubled their consumption of inexpensive and seemingly inexhaustible oil in the quarter century after the war. Anticipating a limitless future of low-cost fuels, they flung out endless ribbons of highways, installed air conditioning in their homes, and engineered a six-fold increase in the country's electricity-generating capacities between 1945 and 1970. Spidery grids of electric cables carried the pent-up power of oil, gas, coal, and falling water to activate the tools of workers on the factory floor. With the forces of nature increasingly harnessed in their hands, workers chalked up spectacular gains in productivity, the amount of output per hour of work. In the two decades after the outbreak of the Korean War in 1950, productivity increased at an average rate of more than 3% per year. Gains in productivity were also enhanced by the rising educational level of the workforce. By 1970, nearly 90% of the school-age population was enrolled in educational institutions, a dramatic contrast with the opening years of the century, when only half of this age group had attended school. Better educated and better equipped, American workers in 1970 could produce nearly twice as much in an hour's labor as they had in 1950. Productivity was the key to prosperity. Rising productivity in the 1950s and 60s virtually doubled the average American standard of living in the post-war quarter century. Also contributing to the vigor of the post-war economy were some momentous changes in the nation's basic economic structure. Conspicuous was the accelerating shift of the workforce out of agriculture, which achieved productivity gains virtually unmatched by any other economic sector. The family farm nearly became an antique artifact as consolidation produced giant agribusinesses able to employ costly machinery. Thanks largely to mechanization and rich new fertilizers, as well as to government subsidies and supports, one farm worker, by the century's end, could produce food for over 50 people, compared with about 15 people in the 1940s. Farmers whose forebears had busted sod with oxen or horses now plowed their fields in air-conditioned tractor cabs, listening on their stereophonic radios to weather forecasts or the latest Chicago commodities market quotations. Once the mighty backbone of the agricultural republic and still some 15% of the labor force at the end of World War II, farmers made up a slim 2% of the American population by the 1990s, yet they fed much of the world. The Smiling Sunbelt. The conclusive economic changes of the post-1945 period shook and shifted the American people, amplifying the population redistribution set in motion by World War II. As immigrants and westward trekking pioneers, Americans had always been a people on the move, but they were astonishingly footloose in the post-war years. For some three decades after 1945, an average of 30 million people changed residences every year. Families especially felt the strain, as distance divided parents from children and brothers and sisters from one another. One sign of this sort of stress was the phenomenal popularity of advice books on child rearing, especially Dr. Benjamin Spock's The Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care. First published in 1945, it instructed millions of parents during the ensuing decades in the kind of homely wisdom that was once transmitted naturally from grandparent to parent and from parent to child. In fluid post-war neighborhoods, friendships were also hard to sustain. Mobility could exact a high human cost in loneliness and isolation. Especially striking was the growth of the Sun Belt, a 15-state area stretching in a smiling crescent from Virginia through Florida and Texas to Arizona and California. This region increased its population at a rate of nearly double that of the old industrial zones of the Northeast, the Frost Belt. In the 1950s, California alone accounted for one-fifth of the entire nation's population growth, and by 1963 had outdistanced New York as the most populous state, a position it still held in the early years of the 21st century with more than 35 million people, or one out of every eight Americans. The South and Southwest were a new frontier for Americans after World War II. These modern pioneers came in search of jobs, a better climate, and lower taxes. Jobs they found in abundance, especially in the California electronics industry, in the aerospace complexes in Florida and Texas, and in the huge military installations that powerful Southern congressional representatives secured for their districts. A Niagara of federal dollars accounted for much of the Sun Belt's prosperity, though, ironically, Southern and Western politicians led the cry against government spending. By the 1920s, the South and West were annually receiving some $125 billion more in federal funds than the Northeast and Midwest. A new economic war between the states seemed to be shaping up. Northeasterners and their allies from the hard-hit heavy industry region of the Ohio Valley, the Rust Belt, tried to rally political support with the sarcastic slogan, "The North Shall Rise Again." These dramatic shifts of population and wealth further broke the historic grip of the North on the nation's political life. Every elected occupant of the White House since 1964 has hailed from the Sun Belt, and the region's congressional representatives representation rose as its population grew. With their frontier ethic of unbridled individualism and their devotion to unregulated economic growth, the Sun Belters were redrawing the Republic's political map. The rush to the suburbs. In all regions, America's modern migrants, if they were white, fled from the cities to the burgeoning new suburbs. Government policies encouraged this momentous movement. Federal Housing Administration, FHA, and Veterans Administration, VA, home loan guarantees made it more economically attractive to own a home in the suburbs than to rent an apartment in the city. Tax deductions for interest payments on home mortgages provided additional financial incentive, and government-built highways that sped commuters from suburban homes to city jobs further facilitated this mass migration. By 1960, one in every four Americans dwelt in suburbia, and the same leafy neighborhoods held more than half the nation's population as the 20th century neared its end. The construction industry boomed in the 1950s and 1960s to satisfy this demand. Pioneered by innovators like the Leavitt brothers, whose first Levittown sprouted on New York's Long Island and in the 1940s, builders revolutionized the techniques of home construction, erecting hundreds or even thousands of dwellings in a single project, specialized crews working from standardized laid plans laid foundations while others raised factory-assembled framing modules, put on roofs, strung wires, installed plumbing, and finished the walls in record time and with cost-cutting efficiency. Snooty critics wailed about the aesthetic monotony of the suburban tract developments, but eager home buyers, nevertheless, moved into them by the millions. White flight to the leafy green suburbs left the inner cities, especially those in the Northeast and Midwest, black, brown, and broke. Migrating blacks from the South filled up the urban neighborhoods that were abandoned by the departing white middle class. In effect, the incoming blacks imported the grinding poverty of the rural South into the inner cores of the northern cities. Tax-paying businesses fled with their affluent customers from downtown shops to suburban shopping malls, another post-World War II invention. Government policies sometimes aggravated this spreading pattern of residential segregation. FHA administrators, citing the risk of making loans to blacks and other unharmonious racial or nationality groups, often refused them mortgages for private home purchases, thus limiting black mobility out of the inner cities and driving many minorities into public housing projects. Even public housing programs frequently followed a so-called neighborhood composition rule, which effectively built housing for blacks in neighborhoods that were already identified as predominantly black, thus solidifying racial separation. The post-war baby boom. Of all the upheavals in post-war America, none was more dramatic than the baby boom, the huge leap in the birth rate in the decade and a half after 1945. Confident young men and women tied the nuptial knot in record numbers at the war's end, and they began immediately to fill the nation's empty cradles. They thus touched off a demographic explosion that added more than 50 million bawling babies to the nation's population by the end of the 1950s. The soaring birth rate finally crested in 1957 and was followed by a deepening birth dearth. By 1973, fertility rates had dropped below the point necessary to maintain existing population figures. If the downward trend persisted, only further immigration would lift the U.S. population above its 1996 level of some 264 million people. This boom or bust cycle of births begot a bulging wave along the American population curve. As the oversized post-war generation grew to maturity, it was destined, like the fabled pig passing through the python, to strain and distort many aspects of American life. Elementary school enrollments, for example, swelled to nearly 34 million pupils in 1970, then began a steady decline. As the onward marching age groups left its wake, closed schools and unemployed teachers. The maturing babies of the post-war boom sent economic shockwaves undulating through the decades. As tykes and toddlers in the 1940s and 50s, they made up a lucrative market for manufacturers of canned food and other baby products. As teenagers in the 1960s, the same youngsters spent an estimated $20 billion a year for clothes and recorded rock music, and their sheer numbers laid the basis of the much ballyhooed youth culture of that tumultuous decade. In the 1970s, the consumer taste of the aging baby boomers changed again, and the most popular jeans makers began marketing pants with a fuller cut for those former kids who could no longer squeeze into their size 30 Levi's. In the 1980s, the horde of baby boomers bumped and jostled one another in the job market, struggling to get a foothold on the crowded ladder of social mobility. In the 1990s, the boom generation began to enter middle age, raising its own secondary boom of children, a faint demographic echo of the post-war population explosion. The impact of the huge post-war generation will continue to ripple through American society well into the 21st century, when its members pass eventually into retirement, placing enormous strains on the Social Security system. Truman, the gutty man from Missouri. Presiding over the opening of the post-war period was an accidental president, Harry S. Truman. "The moon, the stars, and all the planets had fallen on him," he remarked, when he was called upon to shoulder the dead Roosevelt's awesome burdens of leadership. Trim and owlishly bespectacled, with his graying hair and friendly toothy grin, Truman was called the average man, average man. Even his height, 5'8", was average. The first president in many years without a college education, he had farmed, served as an artillery officer in France during World War I, and failed as a haberdasher. He then tried his hand at precinct-level Missouri politics, through which he rose from judgeship to the U.S. Senate. Though a protege of a notorious political machine in Kansas City, he had managed to keep his own hands clean. The problems of the post-war period were staggering, and the suddenly burdened new president at first approached his tasks with humility, but gradually he evolved from a shrinking pipsqueak into a scrappy little cuss, gaining confidence to the point of cockiness. When the Soviet Union foreign minister complained, "I have never been talked to like that in my life," Truman shot back, "Carry out your agreements and you won't get talked to like that again." Truman later boasted, "I gave him the 1-2 right to the jaw." A smallish man thrust suddenly into a giant job, Truman permitted designing old associates of the Missouri gang to gather around him and, like Grant, was stubbornly loyal to them when they were caught with cream on their whiskers. Occasionally, he would send critics hot-tempered and profane SOB letters. Most troubling, in trying to demonstrate to a skeptical public his decisiveness and power of command, he was inclined to go off half-cocked or stick mulishly to a wrong-headed notion. "To err is human, to err is Truman," cynics jibed. But if he was sometimes small in the small things, he was often big in the big things. He had down-home authenticity, few pretensions, rock-solid probity, and a lot of that old-fashioned character trait called moxie. Not one to dodge responsibility, he placed a sign on his White House desk that read, "The buck stops here." Among his favorite sayings was, "If you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen." Yalta, bargain or betrayal. Vast and silent, the Soviet Union continued to be the great enigma. The conference at Tehran in 1943, where Roosevelt had first met Stalin man to man, had done something to clear the air. But much had remained unresolved, especially questions about the post-war fates of Germany, Eastern Europe, and Asia. A final fateful conference of the Big Three had taken place in February 1945 at Yalta. This former Tsarist resort on the relatively warm shores of the Black Sea, Stalin, Churchill, and the fast-failing Roosevelt reached momentous agreements after pledging their faith with vodka. Final plans were laid for smashing the buckling German lines and assigning occupation zones in Germany to the victorious powers. Stalin agreed that Poland, with revised boundaries, should have a representative government based on free elections, a pledge he soon broke. Bulgaria and Romania were likewise to have free election, a promise also flouted. The Big Three further announced plans for fashioning a new international peacekeeping organization, the United Nations. Of all the grave decisions at Yalta, the most controversial concerned the Far East. The atomic bomb had not yet been tested, and Washington's strategists expected frightful American casualties in the projected assault on Japan. From Roosevelt's standpoint, it seemed highly desirable that Stalin should enter the Asian War, pin down Japanese troops in Manchuria and Korea, and lighten American losses. But Soviet casualties had already been enormous, and Moscow presumably needed inducements to bring it into the Far East conflagration. Horse trader Stalin was in a position at Yalta to exact a high price. He agreed to attack Japan within 3 months after the collapse of Germany, and he later redeemed his pledge in full. In return, the Soviets were promised the southern half of the Sakhalin Island lost by Russia to Japan in 1905. And Japan's Kuril Islands as well. The Soviet Union was also granted joint control over the railroads of China's Manchuria and special privileges on the two key seaports of that area, Daran and Port Arthur. These concessions evidently would give Stalin control over vital industrial centers of America's weakening Chinese ally. As it turned out, Moscow's muscle was not necessary to knock out Japan. Critics charged that Roosevelt had sold Chiang Kai-shek, down the river when he conceded control of China's Manchuria to Stalin. The consequent undermining of Chinese morale, so the accusation ran, contributed powerfully to Chiang's overthrow by the communists 4 years later. The critics also assailed the sellout of Poland and other Eastern European countries. Roosevelt's defenders countered that Stalin, with his mighty Red Army, could have secured much more of China if he wished, and that the Yalta Conference really set limits to his ambitions. Apologists for Roosevelt also contended that if Stalin had kept his promise to support free elections in Poland and liberated Balkans, the sorry sequel would have been different. Actually, Soviet troops had then occupied much of Eastern Europe, and a war to throw them out was unthinkable. The fact is that the Big Three at Yalta were not drafting a comprehensive peace settlement. At most, they were sketching general intentions and testing one another's reactions. Later critics who howled about broken promises overlooked that fundamental point. In the case of Poland, Roosevelt admitted that the Yalta Agreement was so elastic that the Russians can stretch it all the way from Yalta to Washington without ever technically breaking it. More specific understandings among the wartime allies, especially the two emerging superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, awaited the arrival of peace. The United States and the Soviet Union. History provided little hope that the United States and the Soviet Union would reach cordial understandings about the shape of the post-war world. Mutual suspicions were ancient, abundant, and abiding. Communism and capitalism were historically hostile social philosophies. The United States had refused officially to recognize the Bolshevik revolutionary government in Moscow until it was 16 years old in 1933. Soviet skepticism toward the West was nourished by the British and American delays in opening up a second front against Germany, while the Soviet army paid a grisly price to roll the Nazi invaders back across Russia and Eastern Europe. Britain and America had also frozen their Soviet ally out of the project to develop atomic weapons, further feeding Stalin's mistrust. The Washington government rubbed salt in Soviet wounds when it abruptly terminated vital lend-lease aid to a battered Russia in 1945 and spurned Moscow's plea for a $6 billion reconstruction loan, while approving a similar loan of $3.7 billion to Britain in 1946. Different visions of the post-war world also separated the two superpowers. Stalin aimed above all to guarantee the security of the Soviet Union. The USSR had twice the 20th century been stabbed in its heartland by attacks across the windswept plains of Eastern Europe. Stalin made it clear from the outset of the war that he was determined to have friendly governments along the Soviet western border, especially in Poland. By maintaining an extensive Soviet sphere of influence in Eastern and Central Europe, the USSR could protect itself and consolidate its revolutionary base as the world's leading communist country. To many Americans, that sphere of influence looked like an ill-gained empire. Doubting that Soviet goals were purely defensive, they remembered the earlier Bolshevik call for world revolution. Stalin's emphasis on spheres also clashed with Franklin Roosevelt's Wilsonian dream of an open world, decolonized, demilitarized, and democratized with a strong international organization to oversee global peace. Even the ways in which the United States and the Soviet Union resembled each other were troublesome. Both countries had been largely isolated from world affairs before World War II. The United States through choice, the Soviet Union through rejection by the other powers. Both nations also had a history of conducting a kind of missionary diplomacy, of trying to export to all the world the political doctrines precipitated out of their respective revolutionary origins. Unaccustomed to their great power roles, unfamiliar with or even antagonistic to each other, and each believing in the universal applicability of its own particular ideology, America and the USSR suddenly found themselves staring eyeball to eyeball over the prostrate body of battered Europe, a Europe that had been the traditional center of international affairs. In these circumstances, some sort of confrontation was virtually unavoidable. The wartime Grand Alliance of the United States, the Soviet Union, and Britain had been a misbegotten child of necessity, kept alive only until the mutual enemy was crushed. When the hated Hitler fell, suspicion and rivalry between communistic despotic Russia and capitalistic democratic America were all but inevitable. In a fateful progression of events, marked often by misperceptions as well as by genuine conflicts of interest, the two powers provoked each other into a tense standoff known as the Cold War. Enduring 4.5 decades, the Cold War not only shaped Soviet-American relations, it overshadowed the entire post-war international order in every corner of the globe. The Cold War also molded societies and economies and the lives of individual people all over the planet. Shaping the post-war world. Despite these obstacles, the United States did manage at war's end to erect some of the structures that would support Roosevelt's vision of an open world. Meeting at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire in 1944, the Western Allies established the International Monetary Fund, IMF, to encourage world trade by regulating currency exchange rates. They also founded the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, World Bank, to promote economic growth in war-ravaged and underdeveloped areas. In contrast to its behavior after World War I, the United States took the lead in creating these important international bodies and supplied most of their funding. The stubborn Soviets declined to participate. As flags wept at half-mast, the United Nations Conference opened on schedule April 25, 1945, despite Roosevelt's dismaying death 13 days earlier. Unlike Woodrow Wilson, Roosevelt had shrewdly moved to establish the new international body before the war's conclusion, so as to capitalize on the wartime spirit of cooperation and insulate planning for the United Nations from the potentially divisive issue of the peace settlement. Meeting at the San Francisco War Memorial Opera House, representatives from 50 nations fashioned the United States Charter. The UN was a successor to the old League of Nations, but it differed from its predecessor in significant ways. Born in a moment of idealism and designed to prevent another great power war, the League had adopted rules denying the veto power to any party to a dispute. The UN, by contrast, more realistically provided that no member of the Security Council, dominated by the Big Five powers, the United States, Britain, the USSR, France, and China, could have action taken against it without its consent. The League, in short, presumed great power conflict. The UN presumed great power cooperation. Both approaches had their liabilities. The UN also featured an assembly which could be controlled by smaller countries. In contrast to the chilly American reception of the League in 1919, the Senate overwhelmingly approved the UN Charter on July 28, 1945 by a vote of 89-2, not least because it provided safeguards for American sovereignty and freedom of action. The United Nations, setting up its permanent glass home in New York City, had some gratifying initial successes. It helped preserve peace in Iran, Kashmir, and other trouble spots. It played a large role in creating the new Jewish state of Israel. The UN Trusteeship Council guided former colonies to independence through such arms as UNESCO, United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, FAO, Food and Agricultural Organization, and WHO, World Health Organization. The UN brought benefits to peoples the world over. The fearsome new technology of the atom put to an early test the spirit of cooperation on which the UN had been founded. The new organization failed badly. U.S. delegate Bernard Baruch called in 1946 for a UN agency free from the great power veto, with worldwide authority over atomic energy, weapons, and research. The Soviet Union delegate countered that the possession of nuclear weapons simply be outlawed by every nation. President Truman said it would be folly to throw away our gun until we are sure the rest of the world can't arm against us. The suspicious Soviets felt the same way and used their veto power to scuttle the proposals. A priceless opportunity to tame the nuclear monster in its infancy was lost. The atomic clock ticked ominously on for the next 45 years, shadowing all relations between the Soviet Union and the United States and threatening the very future of the human race. The problem of Germany. Hitler's ruined Reich posed especially thorny problems for all the wartime allies. They agreed only that the cancer of Nazism had to be cut out of the German body politic, which involved punishing Nazi leaders for war crimes. The Allies joined in trying 22 top culprits at Nuremberg, Germany, during 1945 to 1946. Accusations including committing crimes against the laws of war and humanity and plotting aggressions contrary to solemn treaty pledges. Justice, Nuremberg style, was harsh. 12 of the accused Nazis swung from the gallows, and 7 were sentenced to long jail terms. Foxy Hermann Göring, whose blubbery chest had once blazed with ribbons, cheated the hangman a few hours before his scheduled execution by swallowing a cyanide capsule. The trials of several small fry Nazis continued for years. Legal critics in America and elsewhere condemned these proceedings as judicial lynchings, because the victims were tried for offenses that had not been clear-cut crimes when the war began. Beyond punishing the top Nazis, the Allies could agree on little about post-war Germany. Some American Hitler haters, noting that an industrialized Germany had been a brutal aggressor, at first wanted to dismantle German factories and reduce the country to a potato patch. The Soviets, denied American economic assistance, were determined to rebuild their shattered land by extracting enormous reparations from the Germans. Both these desires clashed headlong with the reality that an industrial, healthy German economy was indispensable to the recovery of Europe. The Americans soon came to appreciate that fact, but the Soviets, deeply fearful of another blitzkrieg, resisted all efforts to revitalize Germany. Along with Austria, Germany had been divided at war's end into four military occupational zones, each assigned to one of the big four powers: France, Britain, America, and the USSR. The Western Allies refused to allow Moscow to bleed their zones of the reparations that Stalin insisted he had been promised at Yalta. They also began to promote the idea of a reunited Germany. The communists responded by tightening their grip on their eastern zone. Before long, it was apparent that Germany would remain indefinitely divided. West Germany eventually became an independent country wedded to the West. East Germany, along with other Soviet-dominated Eastern European countries such as Poland and Hungary, became nominally independent satellite states bound to the Soviet Union. Eastern Europe virtually disappeared from the Western sight behind the Iron Curtain of secrecy and isolation that Stalin clanged down across Europe from the Baltic to the Adriatic. The division of Europe would endure for more than four decades. With Germany now split in two, there remained the problem of the rubble heap known as Berlin, lying deep within the Soviet zone. This beleaguered isle in a Red Sea had been broken, like Germany as a whole, into sectors occupied by troops of each of the four victorious powers. In 1948, following controversies over German currency reform and four-power control, the Soviets abruptly choked off all rail and highway access to Berlin. They evidently reasoned that the Allies would be starved out. Berlin became a hugely symbolic issue for both sides. At stake was not only the fate of the city, but a test of wills between Moscow and Washington. The Americans organized a gigantic airlift in the midst of a hair-trigger tension. For nearly a year, flying some of the very aircraft that had recently dropped bombs on Berlin, American pilots ferried thousands of tons of supplies a day to the grateful Berliners, their former enemies. Western Europeans took heart from this vivid demonstration of America's determination to honor its commitments in Europe. The Soviets, their bluff dramatically called, finally lifted the blockade in May 1949. In the same year, the governments of the two Germanies, East and West, were formally established. The Cold War had icily congealed. The Cold War congeals. Crafty Stalin also probed the West's resolve at other sensitive points, including oil-rich Iran. Seeking to secure oil concessions similar to those held by the British and Americans, Stalin in 1946 broke an agreement to remove his troops from Iran's northernmost province, which the USSR had occupied with British and American approval during World War II. Instead, he used the troops to aid a rebel movement. Truman sent off a stinging protest, and the Soviet dictator backed down. Moscow's hardline policies in Germany, Eastern Europe, and the Middle East wrought a psychological Pearl Harbor. The eyes of Americans were jarred wide open by the Kremlin's apparent unwillingness to continue the wartime partnership. Any remaining goodwill from the period of comradeship in arms evaporated in a cloud of dark distrust. "I'm tired of babying the Soviets," Truman remarked privately in 1946, as attitudes on both sides began to harden frostily. Truman's piecemeal responses to various Soviet challenges took on intellectual coherence in 1947 with the formulation of the Containment Doctrine, crafted by a brilliant young diplomat and Soviet specialist, George F. Kennan. This concept held that Russia, whether Tsarist or communist, was relentlessly expansionary. But the Kremlin was also cautious, Kennan argued, and the flow of Soviet power into every nook and cranny available to it could be stemmed by firm and vigilant containment. Truman embraced Kennan's advice when he formally and publicly adopted a get-tough-with-Russia policy in 1947. His first dramatic move was triggered by word that heavily burdened Britain could no longer bear the financial and military load of defending Greece against communist pressures. If Greece fell, Turkey would presumably collapse and the strategic Eastern Mediterranean would pass into the Soviet orbit. In a surprise appearance, the President went before Congress on March 12, 1947, and requested support for what became to be known as the Truman Doctrine. Specifically, he asked for $400 million to bolster Greece and Turkey, which Congress quickly granted. More generally, he declared that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures. A sweeping and open-ended commitment of vast and worrisome proportions. Critics then and later charged that Truman had overreacted by promising unlimited support to any tin-horn despot who claimed to be resisting communist aggression. Critics also complained that the Truman Doctrine needlessly polarized the world into pro-Soviet and pro-American camps and unwisely construed the Soviet threat as primarily military in nature. Apologists for Truman have explained that it was Truman's fear of revived isolationism that led him to exaggerate the Soviet threat and to pitch his message in the charged language of a wholly global war against godless communism, a description of the Cold War that straitjacketed future policymakers who would seek to tone down Soviet-American competition and animosity. Truman found support for casting the Cold War as a battle between good and evil from theologians like influential liberal Protestant clergyman Reinhold Niebuhr. For over five decades after World War I, Niebuhr crusaded against what he perceived as the drift away from Christian foundations. A vocal enemy of fascism, pacifism, and communism in the 1940s and 50s, Niebuhr divided the world into two polarized camps: the children of light and the children of darkness. For Niebuhr, Christian justice included force if necessary, required a realist response to children of darkness like Hitler and Stalin. A threat of a different sort loomed in Western Europe, especially France, Italy, and Germany. These key nations were still suffering from the hunger and economic chaos spawned by the war. They were in grave danger of being taken over from the inside by communist parties that could exploit these hardships. President Truman responded with a bold policy. In a commencement address at Harvard University on June 5, 1947, Secretary of State George C. Marshall invited the Europeans to get together and work out a joint plan for their economic recovery. If they did so, then the United States would provide substantial financial assistance. This forced cooperation constituted a powerful nudge on the road to the eventual creation of the European Community, EC. The democratic nations of Europe rose enthusiastically to the life-giving bait of the so-called Marshall Plan. They met in Paris in July 1947 to thrash out the details. There, Marshall offered the same aid to the Soviet Union and its allies, if they would make political reforms and accept certain outside controls. In fact, the Americans worried that the Russian bear might hug the Marshall Plan to death, and therefore made the terms deliberately difficult for USSR to accept. Nobody was surprised when the Soviets walked out, denouncing the Marshall Plan as one more capitalistic trick. The Marshall Plan called for spending $12.5 billion over 4 years in 16 cooperating countries. Congress at first balked at this mammoth sum. It looked even more huge when added to the nearly $2 billion the United States had already contributed to the European relief through the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, UNRRA, and the hefty American contributions to the United Nations, IMF, and World Bank. But a Soviet-sponsored communist coup in Czechoslovakia finally awakened legislators to reality, and they vetoed the initial appropriations in April 1948. Congress evidently concluded that if Uncle Sam did not get the Europeans back on their feet, they would never get off his back. Truman's Marshall Plan was a spectacular success. American dollars pumped reviving blood into the economic veins of the anemic Western Europe nations. Within a few years, most of them were exceeding their pre-war outputs as an economic miracle drenched Europe in prosperity. The Communist parties in Italy and France lost ground, and these two keystone countries were saved from the West, from the westward thrust of communism. A resolute Truman made another fateful decision in 1948. Access to Middle Eastern oil was crucial to the European recovery program and increasingly to the health of the U.S. economy, as domestic American oil reserves dwindled. Yet the Arab oil countries adamantly opposed the creation of the Jewish state of Israel in the British Mandate territory of Palestine. Should Israel be born, a Saudi Arabian leader warned Truman, the Arabs will lay siege to it until it dies of famine. Defying Arab wrath, as well as the objections of his own state and defense departments and European allies, all of them afraid to antagonize the oil-endowed Arabs, Truman officially recognized the State of Israel on the day of its birth, May 14, 1948. Humanitarian sympathy for the Jewish survivors of the Holocaust ranked high among his reasons, as did his wishes to preempt Soviet influence in the Jewish state and to retain the support of American Jewish voters. Truman's policy of strong support for Israel would vastly complicate U.S. relations with the Arab world in the decades ahead. America begins to rearm. The Cold War, the struggle to contain Soviet communism, was not war, yet it was not peace. The standoff with the Kremlin banished the dreams of tax-fatigued Americans that tanks could be beaten into automobiles. The Soviet menace spurred the unification of the armed services as well as the creation of a huge new national security apparatus. Congress in 1947 passed the National Security Act, creating the Department of Defense. The department was to be housed in the sprawling Pentagon building on the banks of the Potomac and to be headed by a new cabinet officer, the Secretary of Defense. Under the Secretary, but now without cabinet status, were the civilian secretaries of the Navy, the Army, and the Air Force. The uniformed heads of each service were brought together as the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The National Security Act was also established a National Security Council to advise the President on security matters and the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, to coordinate the government's foreign fact-gathering. The Voice of America, authorized by Congress in 1948, began beaming American radio broadcasts behind the Iron Curtain. In the same year, Congress resurrected the military draft, providing for the conscription of selected young men from 19 to 25 years of age. The forbidding presence of the Selective Service System shaped millions of young people's educational, marital, and career plans in the following quarter century. One shoe at a time, a war-weary America was reluctantly returning to a war footing. The Soviet threat was also forcing the democracies of Western Europe into an unforeseen degree of unity. In 1948, Britain, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg signed a path-breaking treaty of defensive alliance at Brussels. They then invited the United States to join them. The proposal confronted the United States with a historic decision. America had traditionally avoided entangling alliances, especially in peacetime, if the Cold War could be considered peacetime. Yet American participation in the emerging coalition could serve many purposes. It would strengthen the policy of containing the Soviet Union. It would provide a framework for the reintegration of Germany into the European family. It would reassure jittery Europeans that a traditionally isolationist Uncle Sam was not about to abandon them to the marooning Russian bear, or to a resurgent and domineering Germany. The Truman administration decided to join the European Pact, called the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, in recognition of its transatlantic character. With white tie pageantry, the NATO Treaty was signed in Washington on April 4, 1949. The 12 original signatories pledged to regard an attack on one as an attack on all, and promised to respond with armed force if necessary. Despite last-ditch howls from immovable isolationists, the Senate approved the treaty on July 21, 1949, with a vote of 82-13. Membership was boosted to 14 in 1952 by the inclusion of Greece and Turkey, to 15 in 1955 by the addition of West Germany. The NATO Pact was epical. It marked a dramatic departure from American diplomatic convention, a gigantic boost for European unification, and a significant step in the militarization of the Cold War. NATO became the cornerstone of all Cold War American policy toward Europe. With good reason, pundits summed up NATO's threefold purpose: to keep the Russians out, the Germans down, and the Americans in. Reconstruction and revolution in Asia. Reconstruction in Japan was simpler than in Germany, primarily because it was largely a one-man show. The occupying American army, under the supreme Allied commander, five-star General Douglas MacArthur, sat in the driver's seat. In the teeth of violent protests from the Soviet officials, MacArthur went inflexibly ahead with his program for the democratization of Japan. Following the pattern in Germany, top Japanese war criminals were tried in Tokyo from 1946 to 1948. 18 of them were sentenced to prison terms, and 7 were hanged. General MacArthur, as a kind of Yankee Mikado, enjoyed stunning success. The Japanese cooperated to an astonishing degree. They saw that good behavior and the adoption of democracy would speed the end of the occupation, as it did. A MacArthur-dictated constitution was adopted in 1946. It renounced militarism, provided for women's equality, and introduced Western-style democratic government, paving the way for a phenomenal economic recovery that within a few decades made Japan one of the world's mightiest industrial powers. If Japan was a success story for the American policymaker, the opposite was true in China, where a bitter civil war had raged for years between nationals and communists. Washington had half-heartedly supported the nationalist government and Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek in his struggle with the communists under Mao Zedong. But ineptitude and corruption within the Generalissimo's regime gradually began to corrode the confidence of his people. Communist armies swept south overwhelmingly, and late in 1949, Zhang was forced to flee with the remnants of his once powerful force to the last hope island of Formosa, Taiwan. The collapse of nationalist China was a depressing defeat for America and its allies in the Cold War, the worst to date. At one fell swoop, nearly one-fourth of the world's population, some 500 million people, was swept into the communist camp. The so-called fall of China became a bitterly partisan issue in the United States. The Republicans, seeking goats who had lost China, assailed President Truman and his bristly mustache, British-appearing Secretary of State Dean Acheson. They insisted that Democratic agency, wormy with communists, had deliberately withheld aid from Chiang Kai-shek so that he would fall. Democrats heatedly replied that when a regime has forfeited the support of its people, no amount of outside help will save it. Truman, the argument ran, did not lose China, because he never had China to lose. Chiang himself had never controlled all of China. More bad news came in September 1949, when President Truman shocked the nation by announcing that the Soviets had exploded an atomic bomb, approximately 3 years earlier than many experts had thought possible. American strategists since 1945 had counted on keeping the Soviets in line by threats of a one-sided aerial attack with nuclear weapons. But atomic bombing was now a game that two could play. To outpace the Soviets in nuclear weaponry, Truman ordered the development of the H-bomb, hydrogen bomb, a city-smashing device that was 1,000 times more powerful than the atomic bomb. J. Robert Oppenheimer, a former scientific director of the Manhattan Project and current chair of the Atomic Energy Commission, led a group of scientists in opposition to the crash program to design thermonuclear weapons. The H-bomb, these scientists warned, was so deadly that it becomes a weapon which in practical effect is almost one of genocide. Famed physicist Albert Einstein, whose theories had helped give birth to the atomic age, declared that annihilation of any life on Earth has been brought within the range of technical possibilities. But Einstein and Oppenheimer, the nation's two most famous scientists, could not persuade Truman, anxious over communism, communist threats in East Asia. The United States exploded its first hydrogen device on the South Pacific Atoll in 1952. Not to be outdone, the Soviets countered with their first H-bomb explosion in 1953, and the nuclear arms race entered a perilously competitive cycle. Nuclear superiority became a dangerous and elusive dream as each side tried to outdo the other in the scramble to build more destructive weapons. If the Cold War should ever blaze into a hot war, there might be no world left for communists to communize or the democracies to democratize, a chilling thought that constrained both camps. Peace through mutual terror brought a shaky stability to the superpower standoff. Ferreting out alleged communists. One of the most active Cold War fronts was at home, where a new anti-red chase was in full cry. Many nervous citizens feared that communist spies paid with Moscow gold were undermining the government and treacherously misdirecting foreign policy. In 1947, Truman launched a massive loyalty program. The Attorney General drew up a list of 90 supposedly disloyal organizations, none of which was given the opportunity to prove its innocence. The Loyalty Review Board investigated more than 3 million federal employees, some 3,000 of whom either resigned or were dismissed, none under formal indictment. Individual states, likewise, became intensely security conscious. Loyalty oaths in increasing numbers were demanded of employees, especially teachers. The gnawing question for many earnest Americans was, could the nation continue to enjoy traditional freedoms, especially freedom of speech, freedom of thought, and the right of political dissent in a Cold War climate? In 1949, 11 communists were brought before a New York jury for violating the Smith Act of 1940, the first peacetime anti-sedition law since 1798. Convicted of advocating the overthrow of the American government by force, the defendants were sent to prison. The Supreme Court upheld their convictions in Dennis v. United States in 1951. The House of Representatives in 1938 had established the Committee on Un-American Activities, popularly known as HUAC, to investigate subversion. In 1948, committee member Richard M. Nixon, an ambitious redcatcher, led the chase after Alger Hiss, a prominent ex-New Dealer and a distinguished member of the Eastern establishment. Accused of being a communist in the 1930s, Hiss demanded the right to defend himself. He dramatically met his chief accuser before the UN Activities Committee in August 1948. Hiss denied everything, but was caught in embarrassing falsehoods, convicted of perjury in 1950, and sentenced to 5 years in prison. Was America really riddled with Soviet spies? Soviet agents did infiltrate certain government agencies, though without severely damaging consequences, and espionage may have helped the Soviets to develop an atomic bomb somewhat sooner than they would have otherwise. Truman's loyalty program thus had a basis in reality, but for many ordinary Americans, the hunt for communists was not just about fending off the military threat of the Soviet Union. Unsettled dangers lurked closer to home. While men like Nixon and Senator Joseph McCarthy led the search for communists in Washington, conservative politicians at the state and local levels discovered that all manner of real or perceived social changes, including declining religious sentiment, increased sexual freedom, and agitation for civil rights, could be tarred with a red brush. Anti-communist crusaders ransacked school libraries for subversive textbooks and drove debtors, drinkers, and homosexuals, all alleged to be security risks, from their jobs. Some Americans, including President Truman, realized that the Red Hunt was turning into a witch hunt. In 1950, Truman vetoed the McCarran Internal Security Bill, which, among other provisions, authorized the president to arrest and detain suspicious people during an internal security emergency. Critics protested that the bill smacked of police state concentration camp tactics, but the congressional guardians of the Republic's liberties enacted the bill over Truman's veto. The stunning success of the Soviet scientists in developing an atomic bomb was attributed by many to the cleverness of communist spies in stealing American secrets. Notorious among those who had allegedly leaked atomic data to Moscow were two American citizens, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. They were convicted in 1951 of espionage and, after prolonged appeals, went to the electric chair in 1953. The only people in American history ever executed in peacetime for espionage. Their sensational trial and electrocution, combined with sympathy for their two orphaned children, began to sour some sober citizens on the excesses of the Red Hunters. Democratic divisions in 1948. Attacking high prices and high tax Harry Truman, the Republicans had won control of Congress in the congressional elections of 1946. Their prospects had seldom looked rosier as they gathered in Philadelphia to choose their 1948 presidential candidate. They noisily renominated warmed-over New York Governor Thomas E. Dewey, still as debonair as if he had stepped out of a bandbox. Also gathering in Philadelphia, Democratic politicos looked without enthusiasm on their hand-me-down president and saying, "I'm just mild about Harry." But their dump Truman movement collapsed when war hero Dwight D. Eisenhower refused to be drafted. The peppery president, unwanted but undaunted, was then chosen in the face of vehement opposition by Southern delegates. They were alienated by his strong stand in favor of civil rights for blacks, who now mustered many votes in the big city ghettos of the North. Truman's nomination split the party wide open, embittered Southern Democrats from 13 states like their fire-eating forebears of 1860, next met in their own convention in Birmingham, Alabama, with Confederate flags brashly in evidence. Amid scenes of heated defiance, these Dixiecrats nominated Governor J. Strom Thurmond of South Carolina on a states' rights party ticket. To add to the confusion within Democratic ranks, former Vice President Henry A. Wallace threw his hat into the ring. Having parted company with the administration over its Get Tough with Russia policy, he was nominated at Philadelphia by the New Progressive Party, a bizarre collection of disgruntled former New Dealers, starry-eyed pacifists, well-meaning liberals, and communist fronters. Wallace, a vigorous if misguided liberal, assailed Uncle Sam's dollar imperialism from the stump. This so-called Pied Piper of the Politburo took an apparently pro-Soviet line that earned him drenchings with rotten eggs in hostile cities. But to many Americans, Wallace raised the only hopeful voice in the deepening gloom of the Cold War. With the Democrats ruptured three ways and the Republican congressional victory of 1946 just passed, Dewey's victory seemed assured. Succumbing to overconfidence engendered by his massive lead in public opinion polls, the cold, smug Dewey confined himself to dispensing soothing syrup trivialities like "our future lies before us." The seemingly doomed Truman, with little money and few active supporters, had to rely on his gut fighter instincts and folksy personality. Traveling the country by train to deliver some 300 give-em-hell speeches, he lashed out at the Taft-Hartley slave labor law and the do-nothing Republican Congress, while whipping up support for his program of civil rights, improved labor benefits, and health insurance. "Pour it on 'em, Harry!" cried increasingly large and enthusiastic crowds as the pugnacious president trained a barrage of verbal uppercuts on his opponent. On election night, the Chicago Tribune ran off an early edition with the headliner, "Dewey defeats Truman." But in the morning, it turned out that President Dewey had embarrassingly snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Truman had swept to a stunning triumph, to the complete bewilderment of politicians, pollsters, prophets, and pundits. Even though Thurmond took away 39 electoral votes in the South, Truman won 303 electoral votes, primarily from the South, Midwest, and West. Dewey's 189 electoral votes came principally from the East. The popular vote was 24,179,345 for Truman. 21,991,291 for Dewey, and 1,176,125 for Thurmond, and 1,157,326 for Wallace. To make the victory sweeter, the Democrats regained control of Congress as well. Truman's victory rested on farmers, workers, and blacks, all of whom were Republican-weary. Republican overconfidence and Truman's lone wolf, never say die campaign also won him the support of many Americans who admired his guts. No one wanted him, someone remarked, except the people. Dewey, in contrast, struck many voters as arrogant, evasive, and wooden. When Dewey took the platform to give a speech, said one commentator, he comes out like a man who has been mounted on casters and given a tremendous shove from behind. Smiling and self-assured, Truman sounded a clarion note in the fourth point of his inaugural address, when he called for a bold new program, point four. The plan was to lend U.S. money and technical aid to underdeveloped lands to help them help themselves. Truman wanted to spend millions to keep underprivileged people from becoming communists rather than spend billions to shoot them after they had become communists. This far-seeing program was officially launched in 1950, and it brought badly needed assistance to impoverished countries, notably in Latin America, Africa, the Near East, and the Far East. At home, Truman outlined a sweeping Fair Deal program in his 1949 message to Congress. It called for improved housing, full employment, a higher minimum wage, better farm price supports, new TVAs, and an extension of Social Security. But most of the Fair Deal fell victim to congressional opposition from Republicans and Southern Democrats. The only major successes came in raising the minimum wage, providing for public housing in the Housing Act of 1949, and extending old age insurance to many more beneficiaries in the Social Security Act of 1950. The Korean volcano erupts, 1950. Korea, the land of the morning calm, heralded a new and more disturbing phase of the Cold War, a shooting phase, in June 1950. When Japan collapsed in 1945, Soviet troops had accepted the Japanese surrender north of the 38th parallel on the Korean Peninsula, and American troops had done likewise south of that line. Both superpowers professed to want the reunification and independence of Korea, a Japanese colony since 1910. But, as in Germany, each helped to set up rival regimes above and below the parallel. By 1949, when the Soviets and the Americans had both withdrawn their forces, the entire peninsula was a bristling armed camp, with two hostile regimes eyeing each other suspiciously. Secretary of State Acheson seemed to wash his hands of the dispute early in 1950 when he declared in a memorable speech that Korea was outside the essential United States defense perimeter in the Pacific. The explosion came on June 25, 1950. Spearheaded by Soviet-made tanks, North Korean army columns rumbled across the 38th parallel. Caught flat-footed, the South Korean forces were shoved back southward to a dangerously tiny defensive area around Pusan, their weary backs to the sea. President Truman sprang quickly into the breach. The invasion seemed to provide devastating proof of a fundamental premise in the containment doctrine that shaped Washington's foreign policy, that even a slight relaxation of America's guard was an invitation to communist aggression somewhere. The Korean invasion also provided the occasion for a vast expanse of the American military. Truman's National Security Council had recommended in a famous document of 1950 known as National Security Council Memorandum Number 68, or NSC 68, that the United States should quadruple its defense spending. Buried at the time because it was considered politically impossible to implement, NSC 68 was resurrected by the Korean crisis. Korea saved us, Secretary of State Acheson later commented. Truman now ordered a massive military buildup, well beyond what was necessary for the immediate purposes of the Korean War. Soon the United States had 3.5 million men under arms and was spending $50 billion per year on the defense budget, some 13% of the GNP. NSC 68 was a key document of the Cold War period, not only because it marked a major step in the militarization of American foreign policy, but also because it vividly reflected the sense of almost limitless possibility that pervaded post-war American society. The NSC 68 rested on the assumption that the enormous American economy could bear without strain the huge costs of a gigantic rearmament program. Said one NSC 68 planner, there was practically nothing the country could not do if it wanted to do it. Truman took full advantage of a temporary Soviet absence from the United Nations Security Council on June 25, 1950, to obtain a unanimous condemnation of North Korea as an aggressor. Why the Soviets were absent remains controversial. Scholars once believed that the Soviets were just as surprised as the Americans by the attack. It now appears that Stalin had given his reluctant approval to North Korea's strike plan, but believed that the fighting would be brief and that the United States would take little interest in it. The Council also called upon UN members, including the United States, to render every assistance to restore peace. 2 days later, without consulting Congress, Truman ordered American air and naval units to support South Korea. Before the week was out, he also ordered General Douglas MacArthur's Japan-based occupation troops into action alongside the beleaguered South Koreans. Officially, the United States was simply participating in a United Nations police action, but in fact, the United States made up the overwhelming bulk of the UN contingents, and General MacArthur, appointed UN commander of the entire operation, took his orders from Washington, not from the Security Council. The military seesaw in Korea. Rather than fight his way out of the southern Pusan perimeter, MacArthur launched a daring amphibious landing behind the enemy's lines at Incheon. This bold gamble on September 15, 1950, succeeded brilliantly. Within 2 weeks, the North Koreans had scrambled back behind the sanctuary of the 38th parallel. Truman's avowed intention was to restore South Korea to its former borders, but the pursuing South Koreans had already crossed the 38th parallel, and there seemed little point in permitting the North Koreans to regroup and come again. The UN Assembly tacitly authorized a crossing by MacArthur, whom President Truman ordered northward, provided that there was no intervention in force by the Chinese or Soviets. The Americans thus raised the stakes in Korea, and in doing so, they quickened the fears of another potential player in this dangerous game. The Chinese communists had publicly warned that they would not sit idly by and watch hostile troops approach the strategic Yalu River boundary between Korea and Japan, Korea and China. But MacArthur poo-pooed all predictions of an effective intervention by the Chinese and reportedly boasted that he would have the boys home by Christmas. MacArthur erred badly. In November 1950, tens of thousands of Chinese volunteers fell upon his rashly overextended lines and hurled the UN forces reeling back down the peninsula. The fighting now sank into a frostbitten stalemate on the icy terrain near the 38th parallel. An imperious MacArthur, humiliated by this rout, pressed for a drastic retaliation. He favored a blockade of the Chinese coast and bombardment of Chinese bases in Manchuria. But Washington policymakers, with anxious eyes on Moscow, refused to enlarge the already costly conflict. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff declared that a wider clash in Asia would be the wrong war, at the wrong place, at the wrong time, and with the wrong enemy. Europe, not Asia, was the administration's first concern, and the USSR, not China, loomed as the more sinister foe. Two-fisted General MacArthur felt that he was being asked to fight with one hand tied behind his back. He sneered at the concept of a limited war and insisted that there is no substitute for victory. When the general began to take issue publicly with presidential policies, Truman had no choice but to remove the insubordinate MacArthur from command, April 11, 1951. MacArthur, a legend in his own mind, returned to an uproarious welcome, whereas Truman was condemned as a pig, an imbecile, a Judas, and an appeaser of Communist Russia and Communist China. In July 1951, truce discussions began in a rude field tent near the firing line, but were almost immediately snagged on the issue of prisoner exchange. Talks dragged on unproductively for nearly 2 years while men continued to die.